Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. This podcast is for listeners who want to sail the waters of the expansive Indian Ocean to learn about its past and present. Thank you for joining me today. I'm your host, Ahmed Al-Mazmi, a PhD candidate at Princeton University. Today we are here to talk to Professor Rob Marchant, who is a professor of tropical ecology in the Department of Environment and Geography at the University of York in the UK. And today's book is East Africa's Human Environment Interactions, Historical Perspectives for a Sustainable Future, published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2022. East Africa's Human Environment Interactions is an ambitious integration of ecological, archaeological, and anthropological land use sciences, drawing on human geography, demography, and economics of development across the East Africa region. It focuses on understanding and unpicking the interactions that have taken place between the natural and the unnatural history of East African region, and trace this interaction from the evolutionary foundations of our species, which is 200,000 years ago, through the outwards and inwards human migrations, often associated with the adoption of subsistence strategies, new technologies, and the arrival of new crops. The book will explore the impact of technological developments such as transitions to tool making, metallurgy, and the arrival of crops, also involved an international dimension in waves of human migrations in and out of East Africa. Time will be presented with a widening focus that will frame the contemporary with a particular focus on the Anthropocene, which is the last 500 years to the present day. Many of the current challenges have their foundations, as the author argues, in pre-colonial and colonial history. As such, there will be a focus on how these have evolved and the impact on environmental and human landscapes. Moving into the Anthropocene era, there was an increasing exposure to the international drivers of change, such as those associated with ivory and slave trade. These international trade routes were tied into the ensuing decimation of elephant populations through the exploitation of natural mineral resources, which have been sought after through to the present day. The book will provide a balanced perspective on the region, the people, and how the natural and unnatural histories have combined to create a dynamic region. These historical perspectives will be galvanized to outline the future changes and the challenges they will bring around such issues as sustainable development, space for wildlife and people, and the position of East Africa within a globalized world, and how this is potentially going to evolve over the coming decades. Welcome, Professor Marchant, to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, and thanks so much for taking the time to talk about your book.
Oh, thank you very much for the invitation, and I look forward to exploring this really important topic over the next hour or so.
Great to have you. Can you please start us off by saying a few words about yourself, that is, where you grew up, where you went to school, how you became interested in your field of study, and if you would like to mention any mentors along the way?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I'm based in the UK, and now based at University of York. And in fact, I was born not too far away from here in a coastal town of Hull, but I grew up in the south of England in a very, very small community surrounded by forests. And I guess that's really where I had that spark of love for nature and how things work, the entangled nature of our ecosystems. I didn't take a maybe a traditional route of going straight into university. I took about 6 years out after school, enjoying my teenage years in London, doing a whole range of different jobs, but went back to university in my mid-20s to the University of Hull, where again my interest was sort of reignited around environmental geography, botany, ecosystems. And I was very fortunate enough to have set up a small expedition with a couple of friends to work on the seagrasses of Zanzibar for my undergraduate dissertation. And that was really my first introduction into the East African region. Again, was fortunate enough to then to go on to do a PhD also at Hull University, working with Dave Taylor on a long-term ecosystem history of Uganda, probably one of the most beautiful forests I feel in the world, Windy Impenetrable Forest National Park, famous, I guess, for its remaining mountain gorilla population. But I was much more interested in the swamps and the pollen grains and the gorillas of Windy. And through that research, we were able to produce really a nice long-term environmental history going back about 40,000 years. But what really struck me during those formative PhD years was how that forest had shrunk, how it had been cut down, it had been nibbled away over the last centuries and millennia to effectively form a forested island surrounded by this sort of sea of agriculture. And that forested island probably is some of the most valuable conservation land in the world, with the mountain gorilla populations, people paying large amounts of money to come and see the gorillas, stay in lodges around the park. But also it's a vital source of livelihoods and services and medicinal plants to the people that live or used to live within the forest. And presently live surrounding that forested area. So it's this interaction between climate and people that really sparked my interest. That interest was really developed through a series of postdocs, particularly at University of Amsterdam and Trinity College Dublin. And I particularly would like to say thanks to Henry Hoogheemstra, my long-term friend and mentor from the University of Amsterdam, that really sparked my interest in bringing different data sets, different perspectives together. And as you mentioned in the introduction, that sort of interaction with archaeologists, historians, and ecological data. So really that's I guess a bit of a background to myself. I moved to York about 15 years ago now, to set up an institute around tropical ecosystems, and that has continued over those 15 years, waxing and waning through various projects. Currently, I think we have 9 PhD students and 3 postdocs that we're working with, and continuing to do paleoecological work, but also doing a lot more future work. So, I guess to summarize my career over this sort of 30 or so years of working in different locations in Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda. I guess I've moved a little bit from sort of looking down into sediments and back through time to trying to develop methods to look up and forward to try and get ahead of those challenges. And as we all know, there are many challenges out there for many of our landscapes across the world. Challenges around changing climates, around growing and developing populations, around changing international relationships, partnerships, and ultimately trying to achieve sustainable development, trying to achieve conservation of biodiversity, trying to achieve multiple development agendas. Challenges are ahead, but certainly lessons are there in the past.
Thank you for sharing this background. It's interesting to know that you've started your career with Zanzibar, and I wouldn't blame you for falling in love with the region through Zanzibar, as the case with many travelers and explorers and writers about East Africa. Let's now move to talking about East Africa's human environment interactions. Can you start us first with talking about where is East Africa? What is East Africa? What sets East Africa apart from the rest of the African continent, as well as the Indian Ocean world?
Yeah, obviously it's a little bit of a contested term, and there are multiple definitions of East Africa in terms of a geopolitical space. I think the one connecting thing really is the language, Swahili. So obviously this was a trading language linked back to those connections into the Middle East, particularly associated with trade, goods, both from the Middle East into East Africa and from East Africa into the Middle East, as those that sort of East African trade, those East African trade routes developed, particularly over the last 1,000 years. In terms of how it is set apart from the rest of the continent, certainly that language sets it apart. I mean, again, I think the environmental and cultural diversity, as we all know, the African continent is incredibly diverse culturally and environmentally. But in a way, East Africa, I feel, is a microcosm of that cultural and environmental diversity, with multiple cultures and, you know, such a wide range of environments, from permanent ice on the top of the high mountains to really dense, high stature coastal rainforests, montane rainforests, some of the hottest of the biodiversity hotspots in the world, through to, you know, dry deserts, cold deserts on the top of the mountains. So really the whole world comes to play out across the East African landscapes.
Right. And also in situating East Africa and the Indian Ocean, you've mentioned the connections to the Middle East. And perhaps you would like to say more about how East Africa as a region, through, let's say, the last couple of thousands of years, was quite interconnected with the rest of the Indian Ocean world through crops, through monsoon system, and other ways.
Certainly. Let's take those different elements. Certainly crops is a good starting point. And many of the crops that we see today in East Africa have their origins in the Far East, and obviously would have come across the Indian Ocean. Things like bananas, taro, rice, you know, they would have obviously had that sort of trans-Indian Ocean origin, would have been brought in by these early trade networks. Those trade networks, again, as well as bringing in material, would have taken out material, particularly around ivory, and I'm sure we'll come back to ivory, to a lesser degree, slave trading later on in the discussion. But also other, you know, minerals and, you know, obviously there's a trade around gold. And why it was such an important trading area, and that was particularly driven by the monsoons. You know, you had a very favorable monsoonal wind that would carry ships, ocean-going sailing ships, down across the Indian Ocean, down through coastal eastern Africa. And then as those winds reversed to the northeast, they were able to then have a trailing wind all the way back up into the Middle East. So there was an annual cycle of southeasterly and then northwesterly winds that would have carried ships very effectively from the Middle East and into the various coastal ports across East Africa. And obviously that then connects across to sort of the Indian subcontinent. And then, you know, we've got lots of early signs of interaction with China. So it really was quite a globalized part of this sort of world from a very early starting point.
Indeed. And in writing the book, you combined multiple disciplines and trying to write a deep history, moving from geological times and evolutionary times and bringing them to historical times. So can you share with the listeners the research process and the challenges that you faced in bringing these different strands of scholarship together and narrating and constructing a narrative that tells the story of East Africa through time?
Yeah, certainly. And as a paleoecologist, that's my traditional discipline. That's what I did my initial sort of PhD research on. And we still have some paleoecological projects, largely in East Africa, but also in other parts of the world. One of the key things I think within paleoecology is the need to connect to multiple disciplines to understand change. Now, often those changes are driven by changes in climate, so having some appreciation of meteorological processes, climate science is key. Obviously, in an East African context, ocean atmospheric connections are key. We talked about monsoons already, so having some appreciation of oceanography is key. Clearly, people have interacted with their ecosystems at multiple times in multiple places. So understanding cultures, understanding transitions of populations, migrations of early populations, again, is a key component of understanding ecosystem change. And I think, again, throughout my career, one of the things I've really embraced and I think have certainly benefited from is that ability to work with different disciplines, particularly archaeologists, anthropologists, historians, to understand those connections between people and their ecosystems, how that interaction has changed as technologies have changed, as things like iron has been invented, as iron moved across the landscape, as fire management became an increasingly used tool, as crops arrived. We'd mentioned things like rice and bananas. And I guess one of the massive transformation, and I'm sure we'll come to talk about that later on, across East Africa was the importation of maize from sort of Latin America. So understanding those connections between people, ecosystems, and environment really is necessitates a range of different disciplines. And obviously that also ensures that you keep interested. There's a lot of disciplines to connect to. Clearly, you can't be an authority in them all, but certainly having an appreciation of the long term, from evolutionary biologists through to the sort of anthropological works about how people interact and relate to their environment, how the use of medicinal plants, for example, has changed through time, really helps you understand that present day situation of people and their ecosystems. And as I mentioned in the introduction, if we want to try and understand some of these future challenges around sustainability, we really have to bring these different disciplines together to really craft novel and effective adaptation strategies.
Indeed. In narrating the deep history of East Africa, you've started in the first chapter with foundations, as you called it, the environment, ecosystems, and cultures of East Africa. And then we move from that to origins and migration, environmental and cultural change over the last 300 years in East Africa. Well, we cannot cover 300,000 years in this podcast, but in trying to, let's say, compress this big history in a few minutes, how would you describe the shaping of the region in terms of the flora and fauna and the subsequent human influx coming from the African continent, but also across the Indian Ocean later on?
Yeah. Well, I agree. We can't cover such a wide time frame in this podcast. And indeed, it was challenging to do so within the book. And obviously, we're able to do this by zooming in and zooming out of key time periods. Again, I think it's quite important to, in the context of sort of geological timeframes, to again to realize, you know, we're a relatively new arrival on the planet, our species. You know, like you say, we've been around for, yes, again, the timeframes keep on shifting, but say to 200,000 to 300,000 years in terms of our modern species. And clearly in that time, we've had a massive impact. In the context of East Africa, I think that those impacts were particularly driven by inward migration from elsewhere on the African continent. First and foremost, I think, would have been the that first transition out of the Sahara into the Nile as we moved out of the Ice Age into the Holocene. As the sort of green and verdant landscape of what is now the Sahara became increasingly desiccated, that moved particularly pastoral populations south and north. The southern arm were funneled down the Nile Valley into East Africa, particularly arriving in northern Kenya around the Turkana Basin, probably around about 8,000 or so years ago. And those pastoral populations quickly spread across the region. Another very significant transformation, again, within the African continent, was that migration of Bantu populations, predominantly agricultural populations, that spread out very rapidly from sort of proto-homeland in the western part of the continent. And as I say, they were predominantly an agricultural population, iron using, focusing on, you know, traditional crops of sort of sorghum and millets and yams, and were able to quickly spread across the continent. And again, they came to connect in East Africa. We had these incoming Bantu agriculturalists, the incoming pastoral populations. And again, we can see today that interaction between farming populations and pastoral populations, and clearly those traditional populations are now having to undergo quite rapid transition, particularly in the face of contemporary challenges, particularly around climate change, and also as the ability to migrate and have sort of transhumance pastoralism has been curtailed, has been taken away. And again, I'm sure we'll come back to some of these issues later on. Clearly, those pastoral populations are increasingly turning towards a mixed livelihood that involves, in some cases, the growing of crops. External to the East African migrations, we have the external inward flux of populations and crops. And again, I mentioned earlier on this big transformation of the arrival of maize. And we know maize arrived into the landscape around about sort of, you know, in the early 1600s, and really was one of those sort of big sort of Anthropocene markers. And again, you mentioned the Anthropocene being the last 500 or so years. And again, it has a different time stamp in different parts of the world, but certainly the last sort of 400 to 500 years in East Africa has been a really transformative period, particularly driven by the arrival of populations from outside of the African continent. And particularly some of those populations were initially trading and then obviously became increasingly exploitative, particularly around ivory. And I'm sure we'll pick up on some of these issues later on. So I think trying to compress this sort of long-term class perspective is really important in terms of just providing a foundation. Now, as the chapter suggests, it's a foundation of understanding the cultures, understanding the populations which are there in the present day landscape and how they interact with the environment and that environmental and geological diversity I mentioned earlier on, from very high altitudinal ecosystems to very highly biodiverse coastal forests and incredibly rich oceanic ecosystems. So understanding those past transitions, I think, is crucial if we're to understand some of the more recent historical transitions, and then use that understanding to think about some of those future challenges again that I'm sure we will come on to later on.
Yes, thank you for setting this background to our discussion. And definitely knowing the ecological foundations of East Africa would help us to understand the subsequent historical changes and in the subsequent chapters, trading language, new crops, new relationships, digging Anthropocene foundations, and elephants, maize, and pervasive societal environmental transformations. So in these chapters, how would you describe the adaptation, let's say, technologies and attitudes of East African societies towards new ideas, new crops, and new technologies, and in adopting and contextualizing or localizing these new changes, how did that in turn transform the East African environment?
Yeah. So again, quite a few sort of facets within that question. I think first and foremost, I think it's important to realise, and again, the first of these chapters around the environmental history of the last 1,000 years again clearly shows that our environments continue to change. Again, there's a lot of concern, and quite rightly so, on contemporary issues of climate change. And again, as every now and again, we get that continual debate about natural versus anthropogenically driven climate change, and those who like to sort of grind the wheel of, oh yes, it's all natural, will bring out these records to show that climates have changed. But we can see from some of our lake level records, places like Lake Naivasha in northern Kenya, or Lake Victoria, that really is at the heart of that East African region, Lake Turkana I mentioned earlier on, now have changed quite dramatically in terms of their lake level. And that's in response to change in temperatures, precipitation regimes, particularly precipitation regimes. And clearly populations have adapted. They've adapted in the past to these very strong pulses of changing climate, and that adaptability has been possible due to the ability to migrate, to move cattle, and say from lowlands up into the highland forested areas or highland pastures, as climates would change, and it's clearly that ability to move across the landscape, I think, that has been curtailed, particularly through sort of colonial and post-colonial periods, as there become more and more people on the landscape, and that ability of that landscape to allow migration has been taken away. And that obviously brings challenges as well to our species, as they would like to roam across the landscape, as increasingly that ability to migrate, to move freely, has been taken away. In terms of the big transformations that have happened in the last thousand years, certainly that arrival of expansion of that Middle Eastern trade, that development of that Swahili culture, particularly across the coast, and then spreading inland from those coastal environments. It's been one of the big transformations. I've already mentioned a few times maize. I'll mention it again just because I think it really has been one of the massive transformations that have taken place across East Africa, particularly supporting rapid growth of populations, particularly in mountain areas, large-scale transformation of mountain ecosystems to terraced agriculture, to supporting growing populations, but also supporting this growing network of trade. Again, mentioned previously, a lot of that trade was driven by ivory. And again, there's lots of contemporary challenges around ivory trade and ivory smuggling, very much linked into Far East markets. But clearly, you know, the big traders of and foundations of trade were largely European, North American. And that is where the main exploitation of ivory came in and really has transformed the landscape through changing the relationship between the elephant populations and the ecosystems. Today, we all, you know, we can see, you can visit, you know, a protected area in East Africa and watch an elephant, you know, knocking over trees, eating its way through acacia scrub, and they are incredibly transformative. Today, I think we have just around about 200,000 or so elephants across the East African landscape, Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda. We don't know how many there were, but certainly estimates of sort of 20 million, I think, are probably not too far from the mark. And again, we can see some of those historical evidence for the removal of ivory from key ports like Mombasa or Zanzibar, where hundreds of thousands of tusks were taken out every year. Those tusks clearly had to be carried out of the region, and that would then lead to the formation of these very large caravans. So could be thousands of people strong, you know, 1,000 people moving, you know, walking across the landscape 10, 15 miles per day, and then stopping at, you know, well-recognized so-called halts. Again, would need large amounts of calorie, large amounts of food to support these quite demanding, manually labor-driven caravans. And that would then lead to, you know, much more widespread forest clearance, transitions into maize fields to provide the calories needed to carry, you know, very, very heavy tusks, 100 kilogram loads, I say 1,000 people strong, moving into the interior of East Africa, and then moving back to the coast, carrying the ivory with them. And that, again, obviously coming across a number of cultures as through that journey. And again, it's quite well recognized how some of the cultures would engage differently with these caravan trades, some providing support in terms of food or also in terms of the ivory production, killing elephants, taking the tusks out, and then trading to the caravan trades, either with things like cloth or beads, glass beads, largely from places like Venice, or, you know, oil, iron, or indeed in some case arms. So again, there was this, you know, quite rapid transformation, and that transformation spread across the landscape. So today we find relatively few elephants in coastal areas, and those elephants that are there are confined to protected areas like Shimba Hills or Arabuki Sokoke Forest in Kenya. But elsewhere, you know, it's very rare to come across an elephant in these coastal areas because they've been largely removed. And it's not until you go further inland, 300-400 kilometers, that you start to come up to against large elephant populations. Again, today, largely within the confines of these protected areas. So that last 1,000 years has really been, you know, incredibly transformative. But populations have adapted to those transformations, and those transformations could be environmental, changing climates, but certainly they're driven largely by these increasing trade connections through the world. Yeah, you know, obviously across the Indian Ocean, but linked back into particularly Europe and North America.
How would you describe the transition to the colonial period? Is it merely an increase in intensification and volume and scale, or is it a fundamental transformation of relationships with the environment?
I think the latter. I mean, clearly there was a history there. So those transformations and who was behind those colonial transformations, particularly in East Africa, German and British at that time. And that feeds back onto who was driving some of the earlier trades, and also some of those, you know, early explorers as people started to move further around the world, starting to map out the world, starting to find, you know, sources of rivers, and also the church obviously had a massive role to play in some of those early transformations, those transitions into colonial sort of legislation and powers. In terms of their impact on the environment, again, completely transformative. But I think, again, it was sort of standing on those previous caravan trades in terms of the relationships that were there, and ultimately it was, yeah, driven by trade, an increasingly exploitative trade, and a transition of trade. So we've moved from, you know, initially trading elephants and ivory, and increasingly those ivory trades started to dwindle. And increasingly other trades started to evolve, particularly crops and timber. Timber was obviously a big trade of those early colonial transition.
Would you say there was a difference between the different European colonialisms, comparing the German, let's say, to the British, down to the French in the south, or even the Italians in Somalia? Or did they have, let's say, common policies towards forestry, land management, and water use?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. I think you know, there are some similarities, but again, I think they all have their own different fingerprints. I mean, I know certainly the French were very much involved in plantation. Particularly on some of those in Mozambique, and sort of on some of the Indian Ocean islands, and again that continues to be quite exploitative, particularly using forced labour in those plantations. Even within those colonial powers, how they administered the different areas varied widely. So things like Uganda, because when obviously the British were present in Uganda, you know, they already came across a very well-organized society with, you know, political kingdoms, with highly structured societies, well-organized armies, navies. And that was very different to, say, Kenya, where those sort of pre-colonial kingdoms weren't as strong. So again, the actual sort of mode of colonial administration was quite different within individual nations, but also between individual nations. Also, what their interests were in terms of the exploitative desires, be it around timber or gold or ivory.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And in your last two chapters, post-colonial transitions and recent political history, and using the past to chart future pathways, do you feel that the narrative that you've constructed in the previous chapters were yielding, let's say, insights into how the future would be shaped based on previous decisions, or whether East Africans can reinvent themselves in the present moving forward from the past?
No, I think very much the latter. And it is, but it's about also learning from the past, understanding the transitions that have happened, understanding the adaptation processes that have been possible, why certain adaptations have failed, why things like some of the sort of conservation initiatives, some of the climate change initiatives which are ongoing, could be most effective. Certainly requires us to understand a little bit about the past. And you know, a good example, I think, comes from protected areas. So, you know, people often, you know, appreciate countries like Kenya or Tanzania through their majestic wildlife programs that they may see around the world, through things like sort of National Geographic or any other sort of wildlife program on wildebeest migrations across the Serengeti or the Masai Mara. Those protected areas are initially set up as places to have controlled hunting and controlled management of the big five: elephants, buffalo, lions, rhinoceroses. And increasingly, then it became around the conservation of those keystone species. The rationale then changed to be much more around biodiversity conservation. And in the past decade, it's transitioned to be much more focused around livelihoods and supporting sustainable development. So the rationale for the management has changed dramatically, say, in the last 60, 70, 80 years. But the actual boundaries haven't shifted at all. You still have that well demarcated welcome to the Serengeti or Amboseli National Park or the Masai Mara, wherever it may be. So we have to understand in terms of the future those past transitions to really understand some of the challenges around conserving animals, elephants, developing income from say wildlife tourism in protected areas into the future. In terms of adaptation, in terms of crops, in terms, again, there's a bit of resurgence that we see, particularly in the last couple of decades, particularly in the face of climate change, around reconnecting to traditional indigenous crops. A move a little bit away from maize into the sorghums and millets. Again, which have a much stronger tolerance to some of the challenges around climate change, particularly changing seasonalities, changing rainfall regimes. Again, that appreciation of the past can help us inform the future. Clearly, the challenges today are very, very different. There isn't, so in a way, it's not about just taking some sort of trajectory from the past to move, using that to allow us to move forward. But it's about using the past to provide some idea about tolerances around potential restoration targets. Again, there's a lot of interest now in afforestation schemes about restoring degraded landscapes in things like the UN Decade of Ecological Restoration, such as these massive initiatives now to afforest large parts of sub-Saharan Africa. Understanding those transitions in the past, particularly, say, some of the exploitative transitions, is really important in terms of framing those future challenges. Again, through things like the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, there's a lot of debate, and we see this each year, around, you know, loss and damage, who should pay for some of the reparations. And clearly, you know, in places like Tanzania, where there has been extensive exploitation, historical exploitation of forestry resources, clearly there's a rationale there to pay for some of the deforestation that's happened in the past, the defaunification of the landscapes through exploitative ivory trades. So, it isn't a simple transition from taking our understanding of the past and all its nuanced connections between people, their environment, their ecosystems, and just running with that into the future. But it's about using that to provide some context, to provide some idea about what is possible, what could work, what could be challenging, and working with that cultural environmental entanglement rather than, has often been the case, working against it.
Indeed, and as the title indicates, the human and the environment should be both thought of together in the same framework rather than one versus the other. You've covered a vast geography, combining Uganda, Tanzania, and Kenya in the book. Most of the scholarship that we have on East Africa's environmental and agrarian history is centered on certain locales and case studies. So what would you say about having a broader perspective on the region that moves beyond post-colonial nation states and thinking about the region as a continuum or as a collective?
That's a good question. So again, you know, I did have a bit of a sort of inward battle about, you know, what countries to include in this, and ultimately I went with those three major countries largely because that's where I've worked, where my sort of connections and collaborations are strongest. I think there are some common threads, as mentioned right in the beginning, around that connections of language. Clearly within the East African region, Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, there is certainly disconnects or, you know, divergence of cultures. I certainly wouldn't say they are culturally connected, but there is a benefit from what we call, you know, over the horizon perspectives. So, like you say, a lot of the work that goes on is often carried out as an individual location with an individual perspective. But that individual location, that individual perspective has to be informed by what's happening in different locations with different contexts. And that really increases the interpretive power. One of the things I think I've been very fortunate to experience as a paleoecologist in sort of 30 or so years of working across this area with universities, museums in Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda, has been that transition from a purely descriptive discipline. So certainly when I did my PhD, it was sufficient to work in a location and describe change. Where nowadays, because we have this increasing number of locations across the region, that has allowed us to move from a purely descriptive discipline to a much more interpretive discipline, where we can use our understanding to inform contemporary debates, to inform discussions around future land use planning, around nature-based solutions for conservation around where trees should be planted or where they shouldn't be, what tree should be planted in what place, and some of the aftercare issues around our ecosystems. And again, I think these are particularly important in what continues to be an incredibly dynamic relationship between people, ecosystems, and the environment. And I mentioned earlier on some of the transitions that we see firsthand in today in terms of, say, Maasai populations becoming increasingly sedentary, transitioning from traditional cattle keeping to having some sort of sedentary agricultural operations going. So it is an incredibly dynamic landscape that continues to change, continue to adapt. But having multiple insights from multiple locations allows us to take that wider regional perspective, which is really important, I think, particularly because there are clearly global challenges out there. Ultimately, in an increasingly connected world, it is those global challenges which are playing out at a local level.
Indeed. So who do you hope will read this book, and what sort of impact would you like it to have?
I guess ultimately it was written for a sort of undergraduate academic audience. The idea is obviously that it would inform people's research. It would provide a bit of a background to the work that goes on. But also I'm very keen for tourists to read it. People who go on safari, there are hundreds of thousands of visitors per year. That tourist trade is continuing again. Obviously we've had a bit of a COVID-inspired break. But certainly lots and lots of people come to the region, marvel at the culture, the environment, the wildlife, but putting some context to that, understanding some of the issues that they see, so that they can be informed about these current contemporary debates around managing landscapes. And again, we talked earlier on a little bit about, those debates through things like the climate change negotiations and loss and damage, and just providing some context to why those, landscapes and some of the challenges that we see today across East Africa are there. And ultimately, some of the foundations behind some of those challenges certainly lay in a globalized world and not with the individual populations, such as, say, the Maasai.
And I would add, the book is also quite rich in beautiful illustrations, maps, graphs, charts, and would really constitute a very, grounding introduction to East Africa to any researchers who are interested in exploring the different periods that the book covers. Well, we've taken a lot of your time, Rob. But we'd like to ask you the final question, which is, what are you working on now? Can you tell us about your current or future projects?
Yes, so I have quite a lot of ongoing work. I'm actually quite excited to be going back to Kenya on Friday, actually. And one of the populations we worked with for the last 15 years are around southern Kenya. There's a lot of interest in particularly that landscape across southern Kenya and some of the massive challenges which are there, particularly around climate variability and adaptation to that climate variability. So I'll be spending some time with sort of Maasai communities at Indoata, which is just adjacent to one of the famous national parks, Amboseli National Park. We'll be staying in the Manyata, so a traditional Maasai settlement. And there we are. They have set up a tree planting program in the last 2 years. They have set up a green ambassadors program in the last year. We will be doing some sort of training of trainers, having conversations about supporting populations in the best way we can to to really address some of these challenges that they are facing on the ground. Also, we'll be spending some time working with the Kenyan government and the county of council governors on land use planning. And again, just trying to get ahead of the game. You know, as I say, there are so many challenges out there, be it around infrastructure and the impact that it has on the landscape, around climate change, around the 30 by 30 agenda, or the afforestation agenda. Just try and get ahead of the challenges, you know, using participatory land use scenario tools to try and plan a future which is, you know, resilient, and where there is space for wildlife, there is space for people, and adaptation it can be maximized. One last, I guess, long, a little bit more of a sort of slower burn project I'm working on. I do a lot of work with the Mountain Research Initiative. I have a passion for mountains. Clearly, there are some majestic mountains in East Africa, and that was on the cover of the book, obviously, Kilimanjaro. But I'm now working on a book project with Elsevier to do a dedicated book on mountains that will be, yeah, coming out in 2025. So that's a few years down the line.
That sounds amazing. We wish you best of luck and looking forward to having you back on the podcast. Thank you so much for your time today, talking about the book and sharing your thoughts and ideas about East Africa. And thank you for the listeners for joining us to listen to today's episode, in which we explored East Africa's human environment interactions, historical perspectives for a sustainable future, published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2022. This is your host, Ahmed Al-Mazmi. Stay tuned for the next episode of New Books in the Indian Ocean World.